We're going to be in just a moment passing around some sheets that we should have actually done this about 3 or 4 weeks ago when we started, but we wanted to be able to keep track of our Sunday school classes. All the other teachers did a good job in getting names and all that good stuff. I have not yet done so. So we're going to try to do that today, and as this paper comes around, just put your name and phone number on there so we know who's in my class. Now, some of the teens are in my class this morning because Brother Sandiford is very sick. So teens, don't you sign it if you're in Brother Sandiford's class, all right? If you're in Brother Sandiford's class, just pass it on. If you are indeed in this class for American history, then you go ahead and sign it. We'll have a track of what's going on. Our key verse that we've been utilizing is Psalm 33:12. I hope you'll memorize that verse. It would be a good verse for you to memorize. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people whom he hath chosen for his inheritance. The scripture has much to say to not only individuals, and certainly the theme of the scripture as far as on the individual basis is salvation in Christ Jesus. But the Bible has much to say to nations. It has much to say to kings and princes, those that rule over nations. And there is a way as a Christian for you to have the blessings of God in your life, and there's a way as a Christian for you to have the chastisement of God in your life, depending upon how you live your life so as to please him. You walk contrary to what he has for you and wants for you, you'll receive the judgment or the chastisement of God in your life. If you walk as pleases him, you'll find that he blesses you and blesses your life. The same thing is true concerning a nation. And our scripture here said, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. Now, that's not just by mouth only. You live in a nation who certainly when they run their mouth would have you to believe that that was so. But when you examine the lifestyle of this nation, you find that just the opposite is true. This is no more a Christian nation than communist Red China is. No way. This nation professes, perhaps, Christianity, but the Lord talked about those people that with their mouths said they loved him, but their hearts were far from him. And that's the condition we find ourselves in. We're finding more and more of that to be true as we look back to our history. And so we're concerning ourselves with the history of this nation. Hopefully today we'll be able to move through the period of time that you and I know as the landing of the pilgrims in this country. We have covered the conditions of Europe, and I believe part of the problem in teaching history is that I have not found, with the exception of one history, I have not found another volume or another set of history books. I have Philip Schultz's 8-volume set of church history. I have several different histories. Nobody's willing to let you know what's going on in Europe just before Columbus comes to America. And there are several excellent books, and I have a book here that I've used extensively, but at the same time, nobody's willing to tell you what's going on in Europe. And people say, well, it doesn't make any difference. But you're going to find that the atrocities of pagan papacy in Europe, and I don't mean, again, to sound anti-Catholic, but the atrocities committed by the papacy prior to Columbus's coming to America ought to cover 10 or 15 volumes, and yet they are not. I mentioned the fact that the Jews believe that the worst thing that could be done for the history of the Jewish people is to let the world forget what Hitler did in the World War II realm. But I want you to know that what the papacy did prior to this country's founding was 100 times worse, conservatively, than anything Hitler ever did. And you say, well, people say, well, you just hate Catholics. No more than the Jews hate the Germans. You see, you just got to keep some things fresh in your mind, because the only thing that men learn from history is that men don't learn from history. And one of the greatest quotes about history is that people are condemned to repeat the mistakes of the past who don't remember them. And we need to remember that. I'm going to give you some examples. We're finished with the Spanish conquest. We talked about Coronado and Cortez and those men who were really papists from Europe. and came to this country trying to bring and establish papacy, and I gave you some ideas about how they went about doing it. If people don't agree with you, kill them. And that was the rule of thumb in Europe at this time. The Spanish Inquisition and all of those things going on, anybody that disagreed with the papacy was executed or else imprisoned or suffered bodily harm and danger. This is a footnote in a book that I was using, and I didn't read this footnote till the other day, but said an ethnological study now underway in Southern California indicates from aerial surveys and extensive examination of ancient growing fields and watering systems that the population of Northern Latin America at the beginning of the 16th century, which was the time the Spanish began coming to this country, was between 85 and 115 million. A reliable census taken a century later by Spain's administrators in the New World fixes the population at 10 million. If that's true, that means that the Spanish conquistadors and the Spanish Catholics that came into this country killed somewhere between 75 and 105 million people in 100 years. Now, just wanted you to know that. I said you ought to remember that. That's not a Christian, that's a university in Southern California doing that work. And of course, what they're trying to do is to blame all that on Christianity. If you remember back just a couple of years ago, we celebrated Columbus's, whatever the centennial was, for his, and they began to talk about how the Christians came to this country and brutalized the Indians. Well, those people, those kind of Christians weren't our kind of Christians. Our kind of Christians didn't show up till around 1620 in this nation. But it'd be hard to convince them of that. And when they talk about Christianity and the atrocities of Christianity, that's usually what they're talking about. And you need to be aware of that. Now, last week we moved a little bit into the area of the pilgrims. I want to go back and make one more point with the fact that as the Spanish came to the New World, God somehow or for some reason regulated their discoveries in this part of the world. They came to the Caribbean. God allowed them to get into Mexico and Central and Southern Central America. They were able to establish colonies throughout area immediately south of the United States of America. Eventually, they were able to push up into Florida and even across into California from Texas, but they were not able to put a colony on the eastern seaboard of this country, though they tried. The French attempted to come across to the New World, and of course we talked about their explorations of the Hudson Bay area and the St. Lawrence Seaway and the establishment of colonies at Quebec and Montreal, and yet the French for some reason were prohibited from coming south, and they could not establish a colony on the eastern seaboard of this nation. Now, people say, well, that's just the way things worked out. I, as a Christian, don't believe things just work out. I think God has a hand in them. And God did not allow, although Columbus came here almost 150 years prior to the pilgrims landing at Cape Cod, for 150 years, and by the way, the sea explorations up and down the coast of this country were extensive. And yet no one could land or place a colony there. And we talked last week about Sir Walter Raleigh and his attempt during the reign of Queen Elizabeth to establish a colony at Roanoke, and of course that was back in about 1586, 85 when they landed and tried to establish a colony there in what is now North Carolina. The people got very hungry, nearly starved to death, and the governor of the colony set sail back to England hoping to bring relief to those people. When he returned to England, he was just there in time for the Spanish attempt at subjugating England. And, of course, the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588 made it impossible for him to return until all of that had been done, all that had taken place. And it was 2 years before he got back to the colony at Roanoke. When he returned, he found no trace of any colony whatsoever. And to this day, that is referred to as the lost colony of Roanoke. No one knows what happened to them. There were no writings left. There were no remains of any of the settlers. There were no bones, nothing. Absolutely nothing remained when they returned, save four letters carved in the tree, which was, some believe, an inference to the Indian tribe that lived nearby, whether it meant that they had gone to live with that Indian tribe because of starvation, or whether that Indian tribe had attacked them and killed them, nobody knows. There was no nothing to indicate one way or the other. Now, the next colony to come to this country came several years later, and it was under the control of what was called the Virginia Company, which was an English company that decided that they wanted to establish a colony in the New World along the eastern seaboard. That colony was founded at Jamestown, and that became the first English colony in the United States of America. And we went all through it. We'll not go through it again. But the point I wanted to make is that even though the English came next to the eastern seaboard, God did not allow them to get a firm footing here. They struggled. We talked about last week how that nearly all of them perished from starvation. The Jamestown colony was one of the biggest fiascos in English history. Those people there, I'll read to you in just a moment how things transpired, but I pointed out to you the fact that in 1609, the people in Jamestown were near starvation, and the company had from England had dispatched a fellow by the name of Thomas Gates to the rescue. They had heard in England what was going on, that starvation was rampant. They sent Thomas Gates. His admiral was a fellow by the name of Summers. And they left England with nine ships, 500-plus passengers, food, supplies, bound for Jamestown, and ran headlong into a hurricane in the Bermuda Triangle. One ship was sunk immediately. Another one turned back and fled for England and turned home. Gates' own ship took 10 feet of water in the hold, and it was all they could do to keep the pumps running. And they ran aground on an uninhabited island down in the Caribbean. And, of course, they were marooned there in what a fellow called paradise for 9 months. And the rest of the ships that remained had been so tattered and torn in the hurricane that they were dispersed. The fleet was just knocked everywhere. And rather than try and find one another, they all just kind of limped into Jamestown the best they could, which was wonderful news for Jamestown because there were 400 seasick survivors that came on the ships, and they brought with them no food. Jamestown was already on the point of starvation, and 400 more people arrived who were sick from being on the sea for so long a period of time, and all of their supplies had been ruined, or the biggest part of them destroyed in the hurricane and the water that encountered the ships. And so 400 more people are added to the list of those that are already starving. Gates and Summers are able to take their ship, again, I said that 10 feet of water in the hole, they're able to beach that ship on the island and actually got all of the supplies off of the ship without any harm, and even were able to break the ship or dismantle the ship. And they spent the next 9 months out of what they had taken off and dismantled from that ship and the things on the island building two new ships. And eventually got into Jamestown, but it was almost a year later before they were able to get there. But God preserved Gates and Summers, and they had all the good supplies. Everything was fine with them. They were able to save most of their supplies. And so they were there on that island while 400 people with no supplies worsened the conditions at Jamestown. Peter Marshall, in his book, The Light and the Glory, I'll read to you what he says about this time in the history of Jamestown. He said, "Thus did the Virginia colony enter the dark of its soul, the time that would soon be known as, quote, the starving time. All the livestock had been consumed, the hogs, sheep, goats, and a few horses, those that had come over on the last ships, every bit, even the hides themselves. Next went the dogs and cats and the rats that had once thrived on their corn, and any field mice they could find, or little snakes. But the hunger continued unabated and now became ravenous. They dug up roots of trees and bushes and gnawed on them. And every bit of shoe leather on the plantation, every book cover, every leather hinge or strap or fitting was boiled and eaten. The colonists grew so weak that many, lacking the strength to move, froze to death in their beds, and still the hunger raged on. There are accounts of cannibalism that took place, accounts of them digging up their own dead to cook them and eat them. One man was convicted and executed for killing his wife and in order to feed himself, and he had already killed her and begun to eat her when they caught him. And you say, well, that's barbaric. That's what happens when there's no God and man's at his worst. God was not blessing the Virginia colony here for some reason. In May of 1610, Gates and Summers arrived to find of all those, including the 400 and some odd people that had lived there just prior in the winter, 480 when these seasick people got there was the population. Out of 480 that went into the winter, there were only 60 survivors when they arrived. Everyone else was dead. And Gates and Summers arrive on the two ships that they had constructed, and they immediately began to abandon the colony. They were going to take the people back to England and, let everything be gone. It was all they could do to restrain the people from burning what was left of the city to the ground. They were ready to just burn it to the ground and get on the ships and leave, but for some reason Gates and Summers would not allow them to do that. And just before they were ready to set sail, another ship sailed into the harbor. England, having heard, or the Virginia Company, and back in England, having heard that Gates and Summers had been lost at sea, had no idea that they were still alive, had dispatched another governor to the colony. And his name was Lord De La War, D-A-V-E-L-A-W-A-R. And he had come from England, and he arrived just as they were ready to up anchor and sail back to England. As far as I know, most everybody's already on the ship, ready to go back. And he sailed into the harbor, and of course, when he comes ashore, we talked about the fact that he had Gates' chaplain immediately begin to preach, and he stays for about a year and kind of puts things back together. Upon his going back to England, Sir Thomas Dale becomes the governor or the ruler of the Virginia colony there at Jamestown. He's a very, very strict disciplinarian. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned to you last week, it was a hanging offense not to go to church twice daily. He was just tough in that light. And as a matter of fact, his rigid discipline began to improve the conditions of the colony for the first time in its existence. They began to improve. The story of Pocahontas. How many of you heard of Pocahontas? Okay. Her father was Powhatan, the chief of the Indian tribe. And, of course, the early settlers at Jamestown, John Smith to be specific, had gone raiding. They killed a number of Powhatan's Indians and stolen their corn. And, of course, they'd try to trade with them as long as they had stuff to trade. When they didn't, they'd just kill them and take what they wanted. So the Powhatan was a very patient Indian chief. As a matter of fact, if you read the accounts, he's probably one of the most patient Indian chiefs that the American people ever dealt with. He just kind of let it go. And although several times when they had had enough, they came in and attacked. One time they killed a fourth of the settlers that were there. They did keep them in their place. But during this period of time, when conditions began to improve, was the time that John Rolfe, who was a member of the Jamestown colony there, he decided that he wanted to marry Pocahontas. And, of course, that was the first wedding between an Indian and a white man in the New World. He married Pocahontas and took her back to England. Her name was changed to Rebecca. And she went back to England where she was saved, the stories tell us. She accepted Christ as her Savior and became a Christian. She fell in love with England. I guess who wouldn't after living in the woods all your life? She fell in love with England and didn't want to come back. She never wanted to come back to America. The Virginia Company felt like it was in the best interest, if you know they were trying to get people to come to America, they felt like it was in the best interest of her returning to America, so they kind of pushed and prodded until she agreed to go, but she contracted pneumonia and died. She was never able to return to the New World. Her husband, John Rolfe, returned to the Jamestown colony after her death, and he brought with him one little item that was about to become the staple of the American way of life. He brought tobacco from England, and he introduced back into the Jamestown colony the crop that was to be the cash crop for years and years and years and years. So the Jamestown colony begins to cultivate and develop into plantations. The Virginia Company, of course, went bankrupt, had several name changes, and eventually there were 10 private owners that divided up the holdings of the Virginia Company, established 10 different plantations. I mentioned to you the last week that here, after we come through all this time of improvement, after all these years with 10 colonies, there were 1,200 people, and among 1,200 people, there were three preachers. And that'll give you some kind of an idea as to what was going on. For 20 years after the founding of the Jamestown colony, they did not plant crops because of the aristocracy. The English gentlemen believed it was beneath their dignity to plant crops, and it was 20 years before the first crops were planted in the English colony at Jamestown. The first women and children to arrive were in those 400 that arrived with Gates and Summers, or after the fiasco of Gates and Summers. That was the first women and children that had come to the Virginia colony. Now, I said all that to say this. I want to show you what God was doing in not allowing the Jamestown colony to become established. And realize by the time Rolfe and these events take place, by the time the colony begins to get on its feet, the Pilgrims are coming up into Cape Cod. It's not, they're not established before. As a matter of fact, it's a couple of years after that the actual Virginia ordinances are passed and Virginia is established as a self-sustaining colony. The first charter of Virginia, and I read these things to you because I want you to see something. In April, this was written April the 10th, 1606, and I'll just read a part of it. After much to do, says, "We, greatly commending and graciously accepting of their desires for the furtherance of a," "for the furtherance of so noble a work, which may, by providence of Almighty God hereafter, tend to the glory of His divine majesty in propagating of Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the true knowledge and worship of God, and may in time bring the infidels and savages living in those parts to human civility." Now, that's King James wrote that in his charter for these men that came and established the colony. It sounds wonderful. I mean, he seemed to have a desire that these people be one to God, that the Indians be preached to. And the only problem with that is when they came, you remember initially, they brought one preacher with them. And they only brought him because in their own close, they said they could control him. They had no more concern for winning the Indians to God than, anybody in this day and time seems to have. Their desire was to establish a colony. Now, they wrote with flowery language. As a matter of fact, the second charter of Virginia, which kind of amended the first charter after all the fiasco, people starving to death. This one was issued May the 23rd, 1609. It recited all of the first charter and then added some, and this is part of what was added. "And forasmuch as it shall be necessary for all such our loving subjects as shall inhabit within the said precincts of Virginia aforesaid, to determine to live together in the fear and true worship of Almighty God, Christian peace, and civil quietness." He said in order to do that, he gave the rulers of the Virginia plantation, Virginia colony here at Jamestown, authority to make rules and to punish evildoers. Why? He said because they had to learn to live together in the fear and true worship of Almighty God, Christian peace, and civil quietness. That was James's own estimation of what he wanted in the colony there. That charter went on and concluded with this, quote, "And lastly, because the principal effect which we can desire expect of this action is the conversion and reduction of the people in those parts unto the true worship of God and the Christian religion, in which respect we should be loath that any person should be permitted to pass that we suspected to affect the superstitions of the Church of Rome. We do hereby declare that it is our will and our pleasure that none be permitted to pass in any voyage." Again, I said to you, you need to be aware of what's going on in Europe with the papacy. The second of, or the amended charter to the Virginia colony at Jamestown forbid any papist to come into the Virginia colony or to pass through it. Alright? You say, why is all this important? Because when you get to Thomas Jefferson's writings that state there should be a separation between church and state, I just want you to know what he was talking about. That statement was not construed until 1962 to mean that the government should take an anti-religious stand. As a matter of fact, before that time, in several Supreme Court decisions, it was decided that this country was to be a Christian nation with Christian principles, and we'll look at all of those as we come through. That did not change until 1962. And when Jefferson writes that he deemed there to be a separation of church and state, he was referring to a particular church that historians are not going to tell you about. But I'll quote to you so he can tell you himself. I spent a lot of time with Thomas this week. I read all week. I'll give you one example that I memorized. Jefferson said, I do not believe there would ever have been an infidel if there had never been a priest. You think I'm rough. You wait till I read to you what Thomas Jefferson said. You say, what do you mean separation of church and state? Those men did not want to exist in this country what existed in Europe, and that was the papacy running the government. And therefore they established the separation of church and state. That did not mean that religion could not be used in government. That did not mean the Bible was not supposed to be in schools. That did not mean children were not permitted to pray in school. That meant that the papacy did not run this country. That's what it meant. We'll get there sooner or later. But all those things having been said, and all those documents been written, John Smith wrote and exposed what he said was going on in the colony. Now, back during the time when everybody was starving, the Virginia Company couldn't get anybody to come. They were always trying to send new settlers over. That's the way you keep a colony going. And word got back to England about people starving to death, got back to England about Summers and Gates being lost at sea, and disheartened the people. So the Virginia Company published an account called A True and Sincere Declaration. And if you read that document, they state that the main goal of the colony was, quote, first to preach and baptize into the Christian religion, and by propagation of the gospel to recover out of the arms of the devil a number of poor and miserable souls, etc., etc. That's what they told the people of England their first and primary concern was. They only had one preacher over there. And none of the English people were even going to church because they were aristocrats. And so, again, what I wanted you to see is what they were professing is not what they were doing. As a matter of fact, John Smith said this, quote, making religion their color when all their aim was nothing but present profit. John Smith lived in the colony. And his statement was that they had made religion their color while their whole desire was present profit. And so the English colony was not established until about the same time that the Pilgrims arrived in this nation. And though they were here years before, as early as 1585, they failed to establish any type of a lasting colony. And again, I believe the reason, I just don't want you to believe that because they were Protestants, God was blessing them. That wasn't so. Because the English were Protestants, and they couldn't get a colony established. God would not allow the papacy to become entrenched in this nation, nor would he allow the greed of an English aristocracy to come over here and prey on the Indian people. He wouldn't let them be established. Back in England, with the advent of King James I, came the end of the reign of the Tudors in English history. And again, I point out to you three families that rule in England. The Tudor line of kings, and of course in that line you have Henry VII, Henry VIII, you have Bloody Mary, Queen of Scots, And you have all of those there, and the struggle is with the papacy trying to restore it, and then kicking it out, and restoring it. But with the reign of the Stuarts, the papacy was finally kind of pushed completely out of the picture, and the Anglican Church was established. Now, I pointed out to you the fact that when Henry VIII broke with the Roman Catholic Church, he did not change the doctrine of the Catholic Church. That was not his goal. He just wanted to be able to live like he wanted to live. And so what Henry VIII did is he declared himself to be the head of the English Catholic Church, or the Anglican Church. He still espoused all the beliefs and all the teachings of Roman Catholicism, other than the fact that the Pope was not the big man on the campus there. He wasn't allowed to run the show. The Pope excommunicated Henry VIII. Henry VIII excommunicated the Pope. Actually, it came to the point where Henry VIII ran the Roman Catholic clergyman out and established his own clergyman there to back up his desire that England be its own ruling body, its own church. After the death of the line of the Tudor family came the Stuarts. The first of the Stuart kings was King James I. King James I was, in all points, a Protestant. That proclamation that I just read to you was written by King James. It was King James' desire that no Papists be allowed into the Jamestown colony. He protected his realm and established that. But realize that not a lot of changes have taken place in the English church. It is still, by and large, Catholic. And in 1519, at the beginning of the Reformation, of course, John Wycliffe had written in England years earlier, and he had been in rebellion to the papacy. He had written a number of doctrinal statements, or written a number of biblical things contrary to the papacy. When Martin Luther rebelled in 1519, Wycliffe's writings again began to circulate. They had influenced John Huss, and later on, they had influenced the Martin Luther. And now they begin to circulate again, and some changes begin to take place in the English church. Some changes began to unfold there that were brought about largely by Wycliffe's followers. Anybody remember what they were called? They were called the Lollards, or the poor priests. And they were called poor priests because they didn't build big fancy churches and live in expensive palaces and wear gold around their neck. They just went and preached on the street. And changes began to unfold in England. There were two groups of people that appeared at this time that will shape for us the history of our nation. The first was the group called the Puritans. It was not the Puritans that landed in this country at Plymouth Rock. You need to be aware of that. I've read several accounts that said the Puritans established a foothold in this nation. That is not true. The Puritans were a group of people who were Anglicans in religion. They were members of the Anglican Church, and their belief was that they could purify the church that existed then by working from within. And so their desire was to purify. They were called Puritans. And the Puritans made their attempt to establish inside the Anglican Church a system of reform and to bring about the changes that they felt were necessary to bring it in line with biblical principles. Now, they were a biblical group of people. I don't want you to get me wrong. And what they wanted to change in the Church of England were good changes. They wanted to bring it in line with the Scriptures. But they wanted to work from within the church system. There was another group that said, can't be done. They said, can't be done because you can't work under a system where the king or the pope claims to be the head of the church. And this group maintained that there was one head of the church, and that head was Jesus Christ and him alone. And anybody else that claimed to be head of the church was infringing upon the authority of God himself. And this group became known as the Separatists because they separated from the Anglican church. Now, the Puritans initially did not see a lot of persecution in England, but the Separatists did. The English people turned on the separatists and raised huge taxes against them, levied huge taxes against them because they wouldn't support the English church or the Anglican church. They were imprisoned, they were jailed, and they became the brunt of all of the English persecution that had once been levied against the Catholic church. Now they've got their own system established. Now they turned on the separatists. And the separatists, your pilgrim forefathers, were not people that came from England to this country. Your pilgrim forefathers left England and went to Holland because they were being persecuted. Some fellows didn't know that. You're really of Dutch origin. Your forefathers left England because of the persecution, and they sailed to Holland. They lived in Amsterdam for a while, and then they moved on to a little city called Leiden. Leiden in Holland. Their pastor was John Robinson, and John Robinson, this was called the Scrooby congregation. They had left that place in England where the persecution had come. The whole congregation packed up and left. And sailed to Holland and established a place to live there. They had one of the deacons or the elders in the church was William Brewster, and those names will become famous later on. But in 1607, the separatists left England and went to Leiden because they could no longer live in England without persecution. They stayed in Holland for 12 years. And they lived there and raised their families for 12 years. And after 12 years, they decided they had to leave. Decided it was time for them to leave Holland. And several things led to that decision. William Bradford, who also would become famous in the history of the colony at Plymouth, wrote in his books and gave four reasons for their decision to leave again the place where they had placed their homeland. First of all was the hard life that they were having to live. You see, the persecution wasn't completely gone, because they were persecuted in Holland as well as in England. It just wasn't as bad a persecution. But the problem in Amsterdam was that they were foreigners. In Leiden, they were foreigners. They were not Dutch citizens. Therefore, they were persecuted for that reason. And the life that they lived had become so hard that even though England had thrown out the separatists, told them to leave, they were not coming anymore to Leiden because the life was so hard that those people lived. They preferred rather to stay in England under that persecution than to come to Holland and undergo what the people at Leiden or the congregation at Leiden was having to go through. Secondly, he cited their aging. Their hard work and rigorous life, Bradford said, was prematurely aging their number. They were growing old in a hurry. Not only were they growing old in a hurry, but they realized that if they were ever going to do anything about trying to find a place where they could establish and worship God freely, the time was then. They weren't getting any younger, I guess, is the way he looked at it. If they were going to do it, the best time to do it was then. And, of course, you could realize that in 1607, the Virginia colony is publishing all of their little statements about the Virginia colony. And what would appear more attractive to a bunch of people trying to find a place to go and just be left alone than the Virginia colony? And so they were influenced by that. But the third reason that he gave was the fact that their children were being drawn into the worldly ways of the Dutch people. Their children were being pulled and tugged into the worldliness and the fashion of the world of their day, and they were not able to educate their children and give them strength beyond strength according to what they needed to withstand what was going on in Holland. They were being swayed to live a licentious type lifestyle, and these people decided that if they didn't get out, they were going to lose their children. And the fourth reason was, having seen and heard what was going on in the New World, the pilgrims realized for the first time that they had an opportunity to be involved in evangelistic work. And they wrote in their reasons for leaving that their desire was to be able to win people to God. And that was one of the four reasons that caused them to leave Leiden and sail for the New World. Their departure from Leiden occurred July 22nd, 1620. Now, the reason we're told they came from England is because they were English citizens, but also because when they left Leiden, they went back to England to acquire the ships that they needed to come to this country, and also because they were sailing under a charter from the Virginia Company that gave them the right to settle in the Virginia area of this country and establish their colony. They left Leiden, and they came back to England, to Delfshaven, July the 26th, 1620. There they found the first of the ships. There were two that were going to bring them to the New World, and the name of this ship was called the Speedwell. And when they got there, they were informed that there were a number of other people that are also fixing to embark to come to the New World. And scarcely a third of them would be able to come. They were just going to be added to the rosters. It was not all just pilgrims that came to this country. As a matter of fact, the other crowd became known by the pilgrims as the strangers. They were not separatists by any stretch of the imagination. A lot of these people were the same kind of people that had gone into Jamestown. But the difference this time was that the pilgrim influence was going to pervade all that they said and did. They left and went to Southampton from Delfshaven, went to Southampton, where they found the second ship they were to travel in, which was called the Mayflower. And those two ships then were chartered to bring these people to the New World and to the coast of America. It's interesting note that we talked about Christopher Columbus being the fellow that first discovered the New World, and the word Christopher meaning Christ bearer. And the fact that Christopher Columbus, in some of his writings, seemed to express that his desire had been to evangelize the Indians. That was not the way that it turned out, because his hunger and thirst for gold, and also that of the crew that he left behind, actually resulted in the mass murder of more of those Indians than anybody could care to count. But the interesting note is that the captain of the Mayflower was Christopher Jones, another Christ bearer to bring the pilgrims to the New World. God chose another Christopher to bring them over. They departed for America August the 5th, 1620. And they were barely out of sight of land before the Speedwell developed trouble. They had to turn around and come back, and they spent another several weeks. As a matter of fact, the Speedwell tried several times and finally just abandoned all hope of sailing with them. And so they were on their own. It was only the Mayflower that was the head to this country. There were 102 pilgrims on board the Mayflower, and their area quarters, I checked the other day, was about the size of half of our gymnasium. It's where they lived for the entire voyage, 102 of them. So we had 167 the other night down there, I guess, during our dinner in the whole gym, and it was rather crowded. But there were 102 of them in the area about the size of half of our gym. All of their provisions, all that they owned, their children, their sleeping quarters, everything was there with them. They were between decks on the Mayflowers. There was an area there that they had been given in which they resided. They suffered, first of all, with seasickness, and that's easily, anybody ever been seasick understands that. They were not permitted to open the hatches because of the condition of the storms at sea, so they had no fresh air. And, of course, they were down there where the bilge grew ever fouler and fouler as they made their trip here, and the stench and the smell right up there among them. And they lived in those kind of conditions. The crew began to taunt them. There was one interesting story that I read about one of the fellows who made fun of them because they had gotten seasick, and taunted them, and they prayed for him, and he fell overboard and nearly drowned, was brought back on board. And as a matter of fact, later on in the voyage, he became the first fatality. First one buried at sea was this fellow that had openly made fun of the pilgrims. But they made their journey, 102 pilgrims, 66 days at sea. And they arrived on November the 9th after coming through several terrible storms that had blown them off course. And they arrived at what is now Cape Cod up in New England. And if you ever look at a map of the United States, matter of fact, I think I gave you one last week. If you look at a map of the United States, Cape Cod's got that little horn that circles around out there into the Atlantic Ocean. and they arrived there November the 9th in 1620 and sighted land. Again, they had been at sea 66 days and existed that way. They were actually 100 miles too far north from where they were supposed to be. And realizing that, they talked to the captain, and the captain decided that they could sail south and arrive where they were supposed to be. But when he tried to maneuver south, he ran into strong headwinds. Remember those? Back from Columbus? He ran into strong headwinds that made the navigation of the eddies and the rocks along the coastline impossible. So he called them in and made the statement to them that he could get them where they were supposed to be, but he was going to have to put out to sea a day's journey before he would venture heading south because of the currents and the shoals and all the things that made navigation difficult. The pilgrims by this time had been at sea long enough. And they met and prayed, and of course the pilgrims were one group of people that seemed to ever acknowledge God in all things that took place. Kind of like Christians are supposed to be today. And they sat down and discussed among themselves and said, you know, maybe the reason we can't go south is because God doesn't want us to go south. And had they gone south, they would have been associated with the Virginia colony, and we've already talked about what was going on there. So they decided that it was the providence of God that had brought them to Cape Cod, and there they were going to establish their colony. And they decided to find a suitable area to establish that colony. They, on that day, sat down when they realized they were in Cape Cod. Something came to the forefront, and that was this, that they were not in Virginia. They were not in the area controlled by the Virginia Company. Therefore, their charter was null and void. They were in an area controlled by the New England Company, but they had no charter with the New England Company. So literally, they were there on their own. In other words, they had no authority for building a colony. The problem that they confronted and faced was the fact that, as I said before, only about a third of them were from the congregation at Leiden. Most of them were strangers, just settlers coming from England. How do you govern when you're the minority? You had the charter before that gave you the authority to do it, but now you're not in the area covered by that charter. And that's where the Mayflower Compact was born. Have you ever heard of the Mayflower Compact? That was the first form of government in this country on the eastern seaboard that ever worked. And the Mayflower Compact stated that they would hold elections and elect their officials, and they would make laws as they were necessary for the well-being of the colony, and that all would have a part in that government. It was a democratic participatory government that they would establish. And it was established under the Mayflower Compact. So they decide to land and establish their colony. The Mayflower Compact is signed November the 11th, 1620. Now, if you think for a minute, they're ready to get off the boat November of 1620. You might tell me about the timing for establishing a colony. Not real good. Why? November is the beginning of winter. And these people really couldn't have picked a worse time to come and establish a colony. They arrived. Of course, the Mayflower would stay with them through the winter. It was not to leave. Actually, they had an agreement that they were supposed to send goods, that they were, in other words, they were here actually as kind of sharecroppers. That agreement with the Virginia Company was given to them so that they could produce here, that they could hunt, whatever it was, but they were to send their goods back to the Virginia Company in trade for their lands that were here. And eventually there's a big fiasco comes out of this. There's a lot of accusations and a lot of things that the Virginia Company declared to be so that never were so. A lot of money they said the pilgrims owed that they never did owe. And we'll get into that later, I think. However, I'll just say at this point, the pilgrims paid every dime that anybody ever said they owed them, even though there was nothing to prove and there was never anything established that said they owed anything. They paid every dime that the Virginia Company made claim against them for, paid it all. And there were a couple of real unscrupulous guys running the show at that time who later on were just kicked out because of their, less than honest attitudes. But the first effort that they made was to send 16 of their company ashore. 16 of them went ashore and came back, and they had found metal of some type, a metal container inside that thing. They found 36 ears of corn. And that was a sign from God to them that God was going to bless them. Little did they know the corn was going to become the staple of their diet. They had never known corn before. They said it was rather hard to eat. I guess they didn't even cook it. I don't know. But it was rather hard to eat, but it was very nutritious. And so they took that again as a sign from God. December the 6th, a few days later, they some of their own had been sent to explore the inner coasts of the bay. And again, Cape Cod sticks out. And they had gone, actually their first established colony is going to be over here on the land side rather than out on the peninsula itself. And they had sent a group of their own people to explore. And on December the 6th, they first run into Indians. First time they saw any Indians. And these Indians were called Nauseets. They found out later on. I'll explain that to you. They really didn't care too much for the white man. And they began to shoot arrows and all this kind of stuff. And of course, Miles Standish, who was not a separatist. Miles Standish was one of those strangers that had come, and but he had been a commander in a war, and so he was in charge of their defense, and they rushed out into these Indians, fired their muskets, and scared them off, and that became the first little skirmish that they ever had there. That was on December the 8th, and they made a decision then to establish their colony at the little place they were going to call Plymouth. And they called it Plymouth because Plymouth was the last place in England they had left before they came to the United States of America, or to America at that point. And so the colony was established there at Plymouth. Now, to give you some kind of an idea of what takes place, we talked about the horrible death toll down in Jamestown. The death rate ran as high as 90% in Jamestown. And it was not a whole lot better here for the pilgrims. In December, we just talked about them landing at Plymouth in December, six of their company die. In January, eight more die. In February, 17 more die. In March, 13 more die. You know, I've read some books that really indicted the pilgrims for being money-hungry and lusting for adventure. And I'm going to tell you something right now. When people are dropping dead like that, they take all the money hunger and all the lust for adventure right out of you. You know, they kind of portray the pilgrims in a light that, if you study the history, could not have existed. I'm going to tell you right now, you take a congregation this big, it's about the size of the pilgrims. And you figure next month, eight of us are going to die. And then the following month, six will die next month. The following month, eight more will die. Then the following month, 17 will die. And then the following month, 13 will die. Wouldn't you figure you'd be looking for another church? Now, these people were dropping dead. As a matter of fact, out of 18 wives that had come by March, 13 of them were dead. And there were actually only three unbroken families that remained in the colony. All the families that had come had been broken with either the death of a husband or a wife or a child. Only three complete families remained in the Plymouth colony. And you say, why did you say all that? Because you need to realize what they went through to establish what they established in this country and why they did it. They wanted a place where they were free to practice and propagate their own religion. They wanted to raise their children aside from the influence of the world, and they wanted to win the Indian people to the Lord Jesus Christ. That's why they did it. That's in their own words, why they came to this country. That's why they died. In March, a very strange event that was to forever affect the colony of the pilgrims occurred. They were just beginning to enjoy the first thaw and warm weather of spring. And one of the fellows from the lookout station called that there was Indians coming. And actually he said Indian coming. And when they all gathered together and they were ready to fight, one Indian came walking right into the middle of the colony, walked right down the street that existed there in the middle of the colony like he owned the place. And walked up to the group of settlers that were there, and he said, "Welcome," in pure English, and really stymied them. They didn't know what in the world was going on. He spoke their language, and they came to find out his name was Samoset. And Samoset would become one of the most influential men on the colony with the fellows that he would bring them in contact with. Samoset was an Algonquin Indian chief. And a strange thing had happened to Samoset. His village was up in Maine, what now is Maine, up in that area of America. But Samoset had met some of the English explorers that had come down the coast and had landed there near his village, and he had become familiar with them. And Samoset loved to travel. He was a traveling Indian. And he'd get on the ship and go with these guys, just sail wherever he was to go. And he just recently had been dropped off here by a sea captain that had been on a voyage. His name was Captain Thomas Dermer. And Captain Thomas Dermer had dropped him off there near the Plymouth colony, and he just walked right in. And he began to communicate with the pilgrims. The first contact they'd had really with the Indians, of course, that they could understand. They began to talk with him, and they began to ask him questions. One of the initial questions that they wanted to know was, who were these Indians that tried to kill us? And they also wanted to know, why was it that when we established our colony here at Plymouth, did we find fields that had been cleared as though ready for planting, and yet they'd never been planted? Who cleared them? Who does this land belong to? Who owns these fields? And who were these Indians that tried to kill us? Well, Samoset had the answers for most all of those questions. And he began to teach them some things. He told them that the land they were on had belonged to the Pawtuxets. The Pawtuxet Indians had lived there in that area, and they actually were one of the tribes in the area that hated white men more than any other tribe in that area. Matter of fact, they had killed a number of white explorers who had landed there or dared to venture into their territory. They were a brutal, savage people. And they were told that they had lived there, and that just a few years before the pilgrims had come to America, a disease had swept through the Pawtuxet Nation to such an extent that every Pawtuxet Indian had died. None were left alive. And these Pawtuxets had all perished, and they had perished with their fields cleared, ready to plant, but nothing was left. Because of the death of the Pawtuxet Indians and the circumstances under which the whole tribe died, the rest of the Indians were afraid to go to that land. They kind of considered it a sacred land. And so nobody literally claimed ownership of the land. No Indian tribe had gone and said claimed it for their own. It literally belonged to nobody. The pilgrims had, in essence, landed at the only place in North America where nobody was going to contest with them on the land they lived on. If they had landed anywhere to the north or anywhere to the south, they'd have probably been butchered. But God, in His providence, had them land at Plymouth, where nobody would mess with them at all because nobody wanted that land. He also told them of another group of Indians called the Wampanoags. And the Wampanoags were a tribe that were not too far from where they were now living. And their chief's name was Massasoit. And if you again know anything about history, you've heard the name Massasoit. He was the chief of these Indians, and he took them actually to meet Massasoit and wanted them to establish a treaty. As a matter of fact, the pilgrims establish a peace treaty with Massasoit that lasts for 40 years. I'll tell you what kind of people they were. Contrary to John Smith and the company down south that were killing Indians, they established a peace treaty that exists for over 40 years' time duration that the colony's in existence. While they're down there, they meet a fella. He's living with these Wampanoag Indians, and his name is Squanto. Have you ever heard the name Squanto? All right, now we're getting into some history you know all about. And Squanto, actually, more than Samoset, was going to influence the pilgrim way of life. But I mentioned Samoset because without him, they never would have met any of these other people. It was Samoset, the traveling Indian, that took them to meet Massasoit and helped them to establish the peace treaty there. And while they were there in the Wampanoag camp, they met a fella by the name of Squanto. Squanto was an unusual fella in that Squanto, in 1605, years before, now remember now it's 1620, 1621, in 1605, Squanto, who was a Pawtuxet Indian, had been taken from his village by a captain voluntarily, so they say, back to England. And while he was in England, he had been taught the English tongue, and what their desire was to discover who lived where in the North American continent. They figured the way to do that was to teach some Indians to speak English and then find out. And Squanto had been taken back to England. He had been educated in the English language and in many of the English ways. And he had been returned. In 1614, he had been returned to his village there, the Pawtuxet village. And in 1614, another fellow came through and kidnapped, I believe he kidnapped, 20 Pawtuxets and 7 Nauset. Remember, the Indians that attacked them were the Nauset Indians. That's why they hated the white man. 7 Nauset braves and 20 Pawtuxets were taken prisoner and taken back to Spain and sold into slavery by a Spanish ship. Remember the Spaniards. And the only difference was that Squanto was the only one in the bunch that spoke fluent English. And he was pretty smart about European ways, so he didn't remain a slave very long. He found an Englishman going back to England and attached himself to him, got back to England, stayed a little while in England, and eventually came back to the New World. But when he arrived in the New World this time, he found his village deserted and not a trace of anybody that remained. Remember, the Pawtuxets had all died. He heard the story of the last of the Mohicans. He was the last of the Pawtuxets. He got very discouraged. He wandered out into the wilderness, had no purpose for living, he said. He just wandered and actually lived alone in the woods. And Massasoit had recently kind of taken him under his wing and allowed him to live there with the Wampanoag Indians. But still, Squanto was not happy. But they say that when Squanto found out that these pilgrims were living in the village where he used to live and that they were English people, he adopted them as his own people. And it was Squanto then that moved in with the pilgrims. He taught them, first of all, how to catch fish. The story said they had caught one cod the whole time they'd been there. They were not real good fishermen. And Squanto began by going down showing them how to walk barefoot in the mud and squeeze the eels out of the ground and then pick them up and cook them. And they said that they were fat and good tasting. So they learned to eat eels, but Squanto showed them how to get them. And then Squanto showed them how to fish and catch fish. Matter of fact, said they didn't fish, they harvested fish after he showed them how to do it. And not only that, Squanto told them how to plant corn. So much so that by the next year, they had enough corn to get them through another year. They, unlike the Virginia colony, planted enough food to get them through. Now, I'm going to have to end this morning, but I'll end this way. By the next year, their harvest had come in. They had fish. They had game. God had blessed them. Squanto had literally taught them how to survive. And the governor of the colony had called for a day of thanksgiving. And they invited, of course, Massasoit. They invited him to come and to participate in the festivities there of the pilgrims. They're just going to eat a meal. And Massasoit didn't really understand. Of course, you know, he partied in his own way, I guess. And so when he shows up, he brought 90 people with him. Okay? Which was a real shock to the pilgrims because they thought they had enough food to get through the winter. And now once 90 people show up. But he didn't come empty-handed. He brought with him 5 dressed deer, and they say over a dozen turkeys and everything that they could have. Matter of fact, the festivities went on for 3 days. And they celebrated there a time of thanksgiving because God had blessed them to such a great extent. Now, we'll end up there for this week, and next week we'll conclude with the pilgrims and look at some of the other colonies that are established. But the pilgrims now are in America, and they are deeply religious and devoted people. All right, we'll take a break.